welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Archana, a research analyst at ISAS. Before we begin, we wish our listeners a very happy new year. Our guest for the first episode of 2021 is Professor S.D. Muni, an emeritus professor at the Jawaharlal Nehru University and a former ambassador and special envoy of Government of India. He's with us today to discuss the broad prospects for South Asia this year, from pandemic to regional cohesion to developments in South Asian countries, such as renewed civil-military tensions in Pakistan, the US withdrawal from Afghanistan, the rise of Bangladesh, and the current India-China challenge in the region. He will be in conversation with Professor C. Rajamohan, the director of ISAS. Professor Mohan, over to you.
Thank you, Archana, for that introduction. It's a real pleasure to welcome Professor Muni to the South Asia Chat. It's not an exaggeration to say there are probably very few others who know more about the subcontinent and South Asian politics than Professor Muni. So it's really, for us, it's a special privilege to interview him and on the various dimensions of change that is beginning to unfold in the subcontinent. So maybe I can start with Professor Muni on the, has the region become more important? I mean, is there a way of thinking about that as the US-China conflict? We have the Belt and Road Initiative of China, the Indo-Pacific initiative of the United States, then there is the India-China conflict. Have all these factors made the region more strategically significant than in the recent decades?
Well, thank you, Raja, for getting me on this program. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to the ISAS. I have very fond memories of ISAS, and of course, we have been colleagues in JNU. Thank you very much for this opportunity. You are right that South Asian significance has increased in the recent years, but let me throw back a few decades, and you would find, I would say South Asia has always been significant. It has a very sound, what you call fundamentals of geostrategic location. It bordered the former Central Asia, it bordered China, it borders China. It is almost like an anchor in Indian Ocean. But what is now added in terms of significance, even earlier, I think the US was very keen to get allies from South Asia to manage China in one way or the other. What is new is India's importance in the whole region. Earlier, the Western world, major powers had neglected India. India had neglected them. And as a result, there was a strategic schism between the two. That has melted down. And I think the significance of the subcontinent or significance of South Asia, in fact, I am these days I'm more uncomfortable with the word South Asia, but we can discuss it somewhere else. The Indian importance has increased because of its location in Indian Ocean, because of China's rise. You are right, BRI is one factor. But even otherwise, the Chinese assertion all over Indo-Pacific. And that's why, I mean, what is new, for instance, in transforming the word Asia-Pacific into Indo-Pacific is the joining of India. So to that extent, yes, whole of South Asia has, I would say, always been important strategically. And now another additional factor which has been added is the economic potential of the region. You know, in the world, we have almost 1.6, 1.7 billion people living in the space of South Asia, growing almost at the rate of 5.5 to 6% annually. Whereas you find such a region except China, for instance. Therefore, everybody in the world is looking towards this region, not only for strategic, yes, of course, very significantly for strategic reasons, but also for economic reasons, also for democracy, also for English-speaking people. There are nowhere else you have such a huge number of English-speaking people. For the West, particularly Europe and the US. Therefore, there are several factors which add to the what you call the significance and importance, which you have rightly underlined for South Asia.
Mr. Muni, I mean, you mentioned South Asia It was a fairly, it is not a very old usage, and it was invented sometime in the 80s, if I'm right. But the region, I mean, the way we frame South Asia, do you see that actually, even as the region's importance has grown in economic, strategic, and geopolitical terms, but the region itself is fragmenting, right? I mean, I think we passed another year without a SAARC summit. The internal cleavages have become sharper, certainly between India and Pakistan. So the region, one level has become important, but another level, it's also fragmenting internally. I mean, would you agree with that view?
No, you are right. It is, I would put it slightly differently. It is fragmented strategically and politically, if you want to underline it. But it is quite united. It has a huge synergy in terms of culture, civilization, economy, in terms of people, in their norms, their views, their attitudes, in terms of their experiences which they have gone through. Therefore, you have a mix of both, but strategically, and I think that started with what you call the partition of the subcontinent, that this strategic divide got in very, very seriously into this part of the world. In terms of nomenclature, for instance, I mean, this may be an aside, but why the Indian subcontinent, it was called Indian subcontinent, or India and its neighbors. Once partition took place, Pakistan and even to some extent Sri Lanka were not willing to be identified under Indian umbrella. Yeah. So in terms of name, besides the Western interest in strategic significance of the region, there was also an identity problem. And that's why South Asia clicked with almost everyone else. But it did not really change the, what I say, some of these fundamentals, both in terms of strategic and economic composition of the region.
The residue of partition, the bitterness between India and Pakistan, quite clearly has blocked progress in the SAARC, because Pakistan does not want economic integration with India unless some major conditions like Kashmir are fulfilled. So what India seems to have done in the last few years is really, after the 2014 SAARC summit, they need to go along with whoever is willing to go along. I mean, in a sense, we moved towards some kind of a sub-regional cooperation. So do you see, I mean, attempt to construct, okay, while the region as a collective cannot integrate on the economic terms, we could actually do parts of it within the, like the eastern subcontinent, you have the so-called BBIN, Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Nepal. So you see, what kind of prospects do you see for sub-regional cooperation in the subcontinent?
Two things. One is, you're right that India-Pakistan hiatus has actually blocked the progress of regional integration in South Asia. And it is going to do so for a very, very long time to come. To that extent, it is a good innovative idea to look for other options. And the other options is the sub-regional cooperation we have had, as you mentioned rightly, BBIN and BIMSTEC. And with a great enthusiasm, particularly after 2014, we have been pursuing these two ideas of sub-regional cooperation. But let us objectively look at the ground. I'll say two things here. One, that besides India-Pakistan hiatus, even other smaller countries, the question how close is not too close to India has not been resolved nationally in all these countries. There is absolutely no consensus nationally in all other smaller neighbors of India as to how much they can integrate with India and how much identity they should assert vis-a-vis India when it comes to regional and international relations. This is a political issue, and this political issue has not been resolved. And that you find now, I connect to the second aspect, you find reflected in the, despite all the enthusiasm and efforts on India's part, I would say a very slow and tardy progress of both BBIN and BIMSTEC. India is investing a lot of effort, a lot of resources in building this sub-regionalism, but it is not going with the speed it could have been expected. And that's why you find BBI. And the first objection came from Bhutan. Apparently, they talk about environment, but don't forget the identity issue. There are questions of a lot of insurgence on India-Bhutan border. There is a lot of fear of other cultures, Islamic or even Hindu cultures, penetrating deeply into Bhutan, which they want to protect themselves with. These are all issues related to identity. These are all issues related to the sense of being dominated by others or being swamped by others. Now, I'm not blaming Bhutan, but what I'm saying is this is the kind of an understanding or a psychological makeup, which you find as an undercurrent in the policies of all other smaller neighbors. Therefore, India-Pakistan is a major problem in SAARC, but we must not, ignore other aspects of why regionalism has not proceeded. Even after now, almost last 5 years, 6 years, Pakistan has been kept out, BBIN and BIMSTEC. The progress is as slow as you can call for the SAARC. At least
is there an answer for India? I mean, how does India make its smaller neighbors? Okay, Pakistan is a very difficult case, but with the smaller neighbors, is there a way Delhi can make them feel more comfortable, try and depoliticize the economic cooperation? Is that possible at all? Are we going to live with this?
No, it is possible, but you put your finger on the nerves of the whole question in the region, but it is not happening. And it is not happening, one can go in all kind of other reasons, but there are, for every neighborhood policy, there are diverse and conflicting stakeholders in India. And these stakeholders sometimes are conflicting with each other. As a result, in a democratic setup, the Indian leaders find it very difficult to really, what you call, make the right balanced choices. Therefore, I have said that India's neighborhood policy often swings between what you call breakthroughs and breakdowns. Mm, yeah. We have had wonderful decisions in relation to the neighbors, and we have atrocious decisions in relation to the neighbors. So partly it is the structural problem in India, which we have not been able to resolve. And partly it is a question of mindset, because somehow, which I think you are fond of, I have read in your writings very extensively, somewhere the old empire gets reflected. And the Indian diplomats and policymakers are still less sensitive, not adequately sensitive towards the neighbors, not adequately accommodative towards the neighbors, not adequately sympathetic and synergic towards the neighbors. And that creates a problem. I can cite several examples. We don't have time for them.
Yep.
But that is where the problem is.
Professor Mani, I think moving from the general to some specific developments that are taking place in the region, one is the now, we don't know what exactly President Biden might do in Afghanistan, but quite clearly, Afghanistan has fallen off the priority list of the United States. It's reasonable to assume the Americans will withdraw or maintain, at best, a very small presence. And the engagement with the Taliban in the last year and a half now makes it clear that Taliban is going to come back to power in whatever form it does. So it's really where we started in 2001, where we are ending today. It's quite a kind of return to what was the problem that began in the 90s. So if Taliban comes back to power and the current structure breaks down in Kabul, what do you see the consequences, and one for Afghanistan itself, of course, and for the larger region? Because historically, if you look at it, starting going back to Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, 79, since then, the way the region has evolved, partly in the religious politics, the religious extremism, a lot of it had to do with Soviet intervention, and then how the US and the West reacted to it, supporting extremist forces to take on the regime in Kabul. So the region has been so thoroughly transformed by the dynamic in Afghanistan. So now, do you see the same happening now after two decades of relative stability in Afghanistan?
Well, I completely share your concern. And I do see that nothing better than a chaos written there if the Taliban come back to power. And I think they will, because, and this is where Biden may be slightly different from the Trump approach, maybe somewhere bordering on what Obama had carried out. Biden had already stated in a couple of statements that he would not completely, he would hasten slowly in terms of withdrawal from Afghanistan and would not completely pull back. And so long as the American troops are there, the American stakes would be there, even if it is a smaller contingent, they will have to protect them and would ensure that such forces don't come to power who want to steamroll the entire Afghanistan. But the Taliban, the kind of support they are getting from Pakistan, and I'm afraid they'll continue to get from Pakistan, this question is very much there. The unanswered question in case of Afghanistan is, what would be the role of the Chinese? Because they have tremendous influence on Pakistan. And if there is any possibility of moderating Afghanistan exist, it probably exists through Pakistan and China. Of course, I mean, the other sources of support to Taliban, which come internationally, but they are not very critical. So much depends upon how the Chinese response is. The Chinese have so far been sitting on the periphery. They have now entered, sort of entering the circle. They are trying to mediate between Pakistan and Afghanistan. They are talking to the Taliban. And what then would be, I say, the reaction or the implication of US-China relationship, which is unfolding in many uncertain ways also. Your prognosis is absolutely correct, that it is absolutely uncertain as to what will happen. We cannot think of anything more than chaos and confusion in Afghanistan, which will have implications on whole of South Asia, certainly on India. And we have put in a lot of stakes in Afghanistan. If we think that we can replace be a very substantial factor after the US, I'm not very enthusiastic about it. I don't think that is a possibility. And I don't know if there is any concise policy has been drawn in New Delhi on how we should try and cope up with the situation. Though we are now willing to work with China, which is more notional, that in Afghanistan we will train their diplomats or bureaucrats or whatever.
Very marginal, yeah.
There are all kind of, yes, absolutely marginal. It's a token. You are absolutely right. I go with you that there is confusion. I wish anybody had, it's a $1 million question, which nobody can very firmly answer, really.
Professor Muni, I think geography makes Pakistan the most important external actor in Afghanistan. I mean, I think whether it was in ousting the Soviet Union and the Russian armies from there, or giving sanctuary to the Taliban. So it's really Pakistan, the open Durand line between the two countries, gives Pakistan a big role in how things will evolve. But there's also the other side of it. It's a double-edged sword in the sense there is also danger if Afghanistan remains unsettled. A lot of the problems would also spill over into Pakistan. You can already see it's a fairly restive frontier that Pakistan deals with today. So there is a Pashtun movement in Pakistan. There is Taliban, of course, is essentially a Pashtun force. And then the impact of religious politics and how they might shape Pakistan. So you see that this is, Pakistan would be both a victor, but also would become part of the spoils in a way in Afghanistan.
See, what you see in Pakistan is that the facts which you underline, in not only in terms of impact of Afghanistan, but the whole ideology of religious assertion and an uncompromising hostility towards the neighbors, particularly India, has completely stirred Pakistan internally. But at the same time, externally, Pakistan's significance has enhanced. And you said rightly, not only during the Soviet period, Soviet intervention, but even before that, the Americans were using Pakistan for monitoring China and the Soviet Central Asia for a very, very long time. And they have, I mean, you have written somewhere else also about the wealth of power, the Muslim factor in controlling is traditional, even with the British Empire. And that has, that legacy has continued. So internally, so far as Pakistan is concerned, it is completely stirred and destabilized, which you see in terms of the terrorist and all kind of other policies, including cross-border terrorism, which the Pakistanis are pursuing, political instability, which you see, the civil military conflict, which you see. And on the other hand, you see the whole world becoming interested in protecting and preserving Pakistan, whether it is Iran, whether it is China, whether it is US, whether it is Saudi Arabia, or now even to some extent, even the former Soviet Union, that is Russia. So you, because of this strategic location, and I think Pakistan has very intelligently cashed upon this strategic location and covered many of its, I mean, look at the question of terrorism in the United Nations and Pakistan is playing games on the terrorist issue with international bodies, largely because it gets support for its strategic location and it knows how to cash it. So again, I mean, Pakistan is a, and internally the civil-military relationship is not going to change. I mean, we see very impressive demonstrations in Pakistan against the military. Nawaz Sharif has spoken the language which nobody else has spoken. But I don't think the day is nearer when military would be pushed back to barracks.
Mr. Mani, I think turning from the western frontier, which has always been an unstable one, to the eastern frontiers of the subcontinent, Bangladesh has always been an underestimated country, not only in the world, but even within India. I think we really not pay enough attention to the kind of extraordinary economic progress that has happened there, the relative stability that it has enjoyed, and the fact that today Bangladesh economy is bigger than Pakistan's, and it is going to keep growing, and they've done very well even during the pandemic, that it's going to emerge as one of the important economic nodes in the subcontinent. So do you see, what do you see as the long-term consequences of the shift in the economic hierarchy? Well, strategically, locationally, Pakistan is always going to be important. The economic transformation of Bangladesh is going to make it the second largest economy in the subcontinent, and one that is quite attractive for the Chinese, for the Americans, for everyone to deal with.
Bangladesh is important. You are absolutely right. And I think the last few years, the progress which has been registered by Bangladesh is phenomenal. And that has largely happened because of the government exports, largely to the US and Europe. Of course, their service sector is also, I think, more than 50% of the economy is accounted by service sector, 33% by the industrial sector, which is largely the garment industry. But largest section of people are employed in agriculture, and agriculture is still 14%. So they have to find this balance, and they are trying. They have registered an impressive growth rate of, by now, I think, more than 8%. Which is again phenomenal in South Asia. But Bangladesh has always been larger than Pakistan. It was larger in population. It was larger in commitment to democracy. It was larger in terms of their commitment to secularism rather than getting bogged down into one identity, despite the distortions which came up after the assassination of Mujibur Rahman. But all that happened, Bangladesh had the kind of a potential to bounce back, as and it has shown it today. So I think one has to build up, and I quite see it positively that India is building with Bangladesh in a very creative and constructive manner. So Bangladesh is a very important country, and I would say, let me stretch this argument that except for Pakistan, because of a unique internal and external composition, all other countries have the potential in South Asia to grow. Even Nepal, if it sets its political house in order, or Sri Lanka has shown a very remarkable growth pattern in even during the conflict years. So
we'll come to those specific
examples. So what I say, all other countries, and Bangladesh is of course very, very very important, as you said very rightly, and economically, and I think even socially, it would be far more homogeneous and robust society than what you see as fragmentation elsewhere.
I mean, coming to the Himalayan belt, and you mentioned about Nepal and Bhutan, both these countries, I mean, they've always had, you know, straddle between the, originally between the British Empire and the Qing Empire on the other side, and now between India and China. Their location, of course, the stronger China has become, the more important the Chinese factor has become in the Himalayas. We've seen in the last few weeks, Bhutan diversify its diplomatic connection. They've reached out to, you know, establish diplomatic ties with Germany, and more recently with Israel. And you see them, they too have a problem with the Indian shadow, right? I mean, so where do you see Bhutan adjusting to the rise of China, the traditional partnership with India?
To tell you the truth, the Bhutanese would love to have diplomatic relations with China. Again, I mean, if we don't have time to go into details, one of the former prime ministers had very keenly tried to do that. And they find that they can probably handle China by having diplomatic relations. Bhutan has relations with 54 countries, though there are only four countries with which they have, embassy kind of arrangement. Only Bangladesh has a mission in Thimphu, but Thimphu has missions in, I think, Kuwait also, Thailand also, and in Bangladesh. So they have always wanted to come out. Why it is that they were uncomfortable with the treaty and wanted to revise, largely because of the identity problem. And even now, as I said, they would like to have relations with China. But they know very well, and I think the wisdom lies with the Bhutanese king, is still, despite the democratization of the polity, that it is not mercurial like in Nepal, that it plays the cards one against another, against India particularly, to its own disadvantage. Bhutan goes very cautiously. So I think even after it has established relations with China and widened its diplomatic relations with other countries, Bhutan has an office from Denmark also. So it is really widening its relations, and it would want to preserve its identity as an independent country in the shadow of India, but without hurting India's interest or without hurting its own interest, because it knows that in terms of economic and strategic matters, it has to depend upon India, and it has to have a closer understanding with its bigger southern neighbor.
Given the larger size of Nepal, which is bigger than, much bigger than Bhutan, and they have a longer history as a state, there's always a tragedy that, look, they're between the world's two fastest growing economies. They could really, with a bit of internal stability and a focus on economic development, Nepal could really take off in a big way. But yet we've seen repeatedly the inability of the political class, I mean, to come up with the durable arrangements. It doesn't matter for us outsiders and who exactly rules, but where do you see the source of this instability which is keeping Nepal down in a fundamental way?
Well, I think the source of instability lies in the Nepalese ruling elites not being resolved the power sharing arrangement. You know, there is no single faction which is dominant. Even when monarchy was dominant, it was not really dominant because it was first suppressed by the Ranas, and then the democratic forces wanted to have a share in the power structure. And monarchy did not want to share it with them. Now monarchy is gone, and there are different democratic factions which do not find themselves comfortable in the coalition arrangement of power sharing. Unless this power sharing issue is resolved, and it's easier said than done, I think Nepal will continue to see instability. There are huge personal ambitions of individual leaders. There are smaller groups and constituencies which always want to have, you know, even when Prithvi Narayan Shah united, this is what Nepal was in terms of scattered constituency. We often refer this kind of a thing to Afghanistan, but at a smaller scale, you had that in Nepal socially and historically. And those identities and those stakeholders or vested interests, if you want to call it, and particular you know, attraction to power and who gets patronage has not really gone. But in addition to that, I think we have also, India has also not played its cards very well. I think India could do much better than what it did in case of Nepal. We assured them first, you know, constitutional monarchy and then democratic setup, and we really did not pursue it. From 1951 until 1959 elections, we dilly-dallied with that. And even after that, even today, I think we want, okay, let there be a monarchy, we can deal with it, that will help us contain communism, so on and so forth. There is a lot of what you call muddy thinking strategically in dealing with Nepal on various sides. Now, China has come in a big way, and probably we will discuss China separately. But therefore, Nepal is oscillating from one attractive pole to another attractive pole without thinking really what it means in terms of stabilizing the country. And now there is a new Nepal. So I think the present leadership will find it increasingly difficult to manage situations. And you will see more of a turbulence and instability in that country.
Coming to from the Himalayas to the Indian Ocean, we have two island states, Sri Lanka and Maldives. I mean, you dealt with Sri Lanka for long years, and you also engaged with Maldives. Now, in both these, I mean, you talked about the Chinese presence. I think one of the great transformations that we've seen in Sri Lanka has been really the dramatic expansion of Chinese economic presence and the goodwill they've created politically within Sri Lanka. We've seen in Maldives the opposite. I mean, I think there was a regime before the current one which seemed to go totally with the Chinese, and later it is moved away. And we've seen the Maldives now reaching out to the US and UK and other forces. So you see the island states politics in both Sri Lanka and Maldives changing profoundly, and what kind of a longer term bearing it might have on the region.
Well, Sri Lanka has always maintained a balance away from India. You know, Sri Lanka looked at its defense not from India, from the British. They had this defense agreement with them. And even in the earlier days, see the debates between Nehru and John Kotlawala on ideological issues. They were always maintaining a distance from India. And there also the internal problems have kept them away in terms of India's identity is concerned. Maldives does not have that kind of an internal problem vis-a-vis India. And Maldives has generally adjusted well with India, except for the aberration of, the Yameen regime, which was there for a short while. By and large, Maldives has, and now, of course, the Chinese push, which has come in a big way. And both in Sri Lanka, and I would say not only in Sri Lanka and Maldives, but also in terms of Nepal, now India is looking for or willing to adjust with other outside powers, particularly the US. US and Britain had a long eye on Maldives for a long time. Even when Nasheed was there, they wanted to have a foothold there. They have had a strategic. India was uncomfortable at that time, but not now because of the Chinese pressures. So Maldives is slightly, I would put it differently in terms of equation with India, so far as Sri Lanka is concerned. Sri Lanka, even in 1962, wanted to maintain a balance between the two. Even, you know, the Indian Ocean as a zone of peace proposal, Mrs. Bandaranaike was keen that her name, she should initiate it. Because being an Indian Ocean country. So Sri Lanka is far more articulate, far more urbane and westernized than Maldives, and therefore far more broader looking in terms of world relations. They wanted to be the first of South Asian countries to become member of ASEAN. Yeah. So you have Sri Lanka is a different trend. They are far more articulate. Legally, they are very strong people. I think much better than many Indians also in international gatherings and others. So Sri Lanka has its own place, so to say. But in terms of Indian Ocean security, I think both are now realizing that. Well, they even wanted to play with China in terms of submarine and all that, largely to balance India. But now I hope they have realized that this is not a good game. It's a fairly dangerous game for Sri Lanka itself. So let us hope that in Sri Lanka and Maldives would now have more of a South Asian strategic integration rather than what we could think of it earlier.
Professor Mani, I think throughout our conversation the last half an hour or so, I mean, China has been the constant factor, which has kept figuring that if you look at the last half a century or more, I mean, since the time India, South Asia got independence, it's really, China has emerged as the most important external power in the region. Partly, China is the second largest economy, soon to be the number one. They have the political will to exercise, you know, the kind of strategic policies. So all this is making China's role in our region profoundly important, and is one that is going to rise. So how do you see the longer term implications of China's role in our region?
Well, Chinese role even earlier, whenever China was more assertive, the South Asian countries have tilted towards them. And now I find in the last decade particularly, the Chinese have their own agenda about South Asia. I make a distinction that before a decade or before the beginning of this century, let me say, China came to South Asian affairs when it was dragged by some of the South Asian countries to balance India. And it willingly came at that time, whether it was Sri Lanka when, you know, even that rubber rice agreement in 52, which Sri Lanka was largely because the Americans wanted to put sanctions and strategic material in rubber and all that, but the Chinese went ahead, Sri Lankans went ahead. And in several cases in Nepal, several cases in Bangladesh, Pakistan, of course, is a typical example that whenever it was dragged in, it came in. But now it has its own agenda. And I have a feeling that even if these countries become somewhat hesitant in interacting with China, China will force them into a closer interaction with it, because it has its own drivers of South Asia policy besides the BRI, besides China's rise in Asia and assertion in Asia. All these factors are correct under President Xi's leadership. But the South Asian relevant factor is that it has stakes in South Asia. And if you give me half a minute, I'll just list four of them. One is that its own periphery, Xinjiang and Tibet, are still unstable. It is a debatable issue, but I stand on my ground. It is unstable so far, and therefore, if it has to stabilize and let both Xinjiang and Tibet grow, it will need the support of the neighboring countries. And who are the neighboring countries? Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Bhutan, Nepal, Myanmar. These are the countries which are neighboring. So first is the vulnerable periphery. Then secondly, as I mentioned earlier, South Asia's economic potential, China cannot ignore. 1.6 billion people growing at the rate of 5 or 6%, as a huge market, it just cannot. And that's why its own surplus capacities can be best used in South Asia. Third is the so-called Malacca dilemma, which people call. And fourth is Chinese fear that if they did not do anything, the Americans and other adversarial powers will mobilize these countries. And there are examples. You know that the Tibet war was fought by the Kampas through the American support, and the Chinese had to face that. So these are the reasons why China itself is interested in South Asia deeply. And therefore, a lot of pressure would come. And that's why you see China is increasingly interested even in the political regime. There is a regime change competition with India in South Asia, so far as China is concerned, largely. It didn't do it earlier. It is doing it now. It is willing to invest billions of dollars. It is willing to cultivate the defense services of all the South Asian countries, not only one or two. Therefore, I find the Chinese challenge is far bigger for India and for these countries to deal with their security affairs, to deal with their economic affairs. And there are still no clear directions which indicate how these countries are going to cope with this kind of a challenge. I think that's where I can leave it.
Mr. Mani, I think we've covered a lot of ground, but there's one last question to be talked about. I mean, you work a lot on India's foreign policy, India's neighborhood policy. Given all that we've talked about, you know, we talked about the broader trends as well as the individual dynamics in various countries. Are you optimistic? I mean, that there are some days when people feel, look, India is doing badly in the neighborhood. Some other days you think, look, India is too important geographically that it can't be just pushed aside. Are you optimistic in the longer term that India can construct a framework for more productive, positive engagement with at least the neighbors which are other than Pakistan in the near term?
Well, I sometimes wonder, Raja, that why India is not doing it. I'm quite convinced that it is capable. I'm quite convinced that it can have a far more synergized relationship with its smaller neighbors. And still we are not doing it. And that's where I said the failure lies in our structure. I mean, the India's finance and commerce ministry is not on the same wavelength as the defense and external affairs ministry when it comes to dealing with the neighbors. The home ministry would have its own. I mean, this kind of a coordination. Then you have all kind of business interest, all kind of family social interest. You have the bordering states, the federal interest which come up. You have political parties' interest. For instance, today, I mean, the ruling party in India, BJP, is so keen to establish itself in West Bengal on the one hand and Tamil Nadu on the other hand, which has a direct consequence for India's relations with Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. And you can see that in the Teesta. Why Mr. Modi, with all his power, cannot sign the Teesta agreement, I don't understand. Why the present regime in India cannot resolve the fisherman issue in terms of Sri Lanka, except for the local interest, which they have to take into account. So, you know, what they do is that they ignore the larger interest for smaller and immediate political gains, which is a part of the system dynamics. And I see no reason why it cannot be corrected. I mean, it was corrected. Nehru, to a very large extent, did that. I mean, he ignored it. Even to some extent, Mrs. Gandhi and Rajiv Gandhi also ignored some of these interests and dealt with them. They succumbed also. As I said, the overall India's policy is swinging between brilliance and blunders, or between breakthroughs and breakdowns. But that is largely because we have not been able to cope with the assets which we have, and we have not been able to respond to the liabilities which are there before us.
So, Mani, I think you've given us a lot of insights, and we really, ISAS, on behalf of ISAS, really thank you for that. And we hope that the number of issues we've talked about today, a lot of them are going to keep coming up down the year. We hope to continue to host you on this, and hopefully this year we can even see you in the Institute. So thank you again for joining us today on the South Asia Chat. And this is a weekly podcast from on behalf of the Institute of South Asian Studies. Every Tuesday, we have this podcast. So all the listeners, please join us again on every Tuesday on the South Asia Chat with the Institute of South Asian Studies. Thank you.
Was a pleasure, as always, talking to you, Rajamohan. Thank you very much.